Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and once again, it's my pleasure and privilege to present Mike Rupert, former Los Angeles Police Department narcotics detective, who for many years now has been crusading on the subject of the intelligence community and drugs. We've been speaking about the Tyree suit. That's something that we've covered on a couple of previous broadcasts. It's a lawsuit filed by a former Green Beret who was framed for the murder of his wife, and or allegedly framed for the murder of his wife. I believe he was. On the basis of the academic information I've seen, the judge in that case believes that he was innocent as well. And we've been speaking about a fascinating individual named Albert Vincent Caron, who has worn variously the hats of CIA operative, Army officer, New York City police detective, and also as an intimate of organized crime. One of the many names that crops up in connection with the Turple Wilson operations that went on in the 1970s and were finally interdicted as the 80s began among the names were Theodore Shackley and Thomas Kleins. Mike, tell us briefly who Theodore Shackley was for the benefit of people who don't know the name.
Well, Ted Shackley joined the agency, I believe, sometime in the late 40s. He first gets any historical reference in connection with J.M. Wave and Operation Mongoose run out of the Miami station in the 60s, which were the operations designed to assassinate or overthrow Fidel Castro. He worked with Ed Lansdale, who was the nefarious, notorious CIA guy of all times in that era, and was first connected to the Cubans from the Bay of Pigs who turn up all the way through Iran-Contra, Felix Rodriguez, Frank Castro, Chanez, Nunez, the whole crew from 2506 that used to blow up airliners and everything else.
That's Brigade 2506 that landed in the Bay of Pigs.
Right. Shackley was station chief in Laos in the 60s, which was at the time, and I believe it still is to this day, the single largest covert operation CIA has ever run, which was a whole secret war which was funded by heroin. That was where Air America was, the CIA airline, was documented flying, you know, tons and tons of heroin out of the Golden Triangle through Vientiane and a number of airfields in Laos and Burma and Thailand. He came back to the States and later served as station chief in Saigon during the war, and came back, and in the late 70s, as a result of the Wilson case, I believe, and also stuff that Richard Secord had gotten into where he got caught with his hands dirty behind Itzko and some shipments for the Egyptians, Shackley retired, but he has not been inactive. I was in Washington living in 94 and 95, and I met with a former CIA case officer many, many times. He's still a friend to this day who hated Oliver North. But he showed me that when Oliver North ran for the Senate in Virginia, which was in, 95, I believe it was.
In 94, he was one of the very few Republicans who was defeated when the Gingrich Congress came in.
Right. But Oliver North was leasing office space from Ted Shackley for that campaign.
Fascinating. So Theodore Shackley, one of the most important individuals in recent American history, but a name that most Americans do not know, was by no means reticent after the Iran-Contra affair.
No, absolutely not. And Shackley was tied more or less through Tom Kleins got his hands dirty for income tax evasion behind Iran-Contra. Shackley and Kleins' names turn up more in connection with the Manushir Gurbanifars and the Albert Hakims and the Adnan Khashoggis and that whole Middle Eastern end of the operation. But Shackley's been a player for a long time. So when I first met and spent time with Dee Ferdinand in New Mexico and realized, I mean, her family was ruined by what happened after her father was murdered. He died of chemical toxicity of unknown etiology. This is Colonel Al Caron.
And by the way, we should add him to the list of suspicious deaths that have taken place in connection with this case.
Absolutely. I've seen all the death reports. I mean, there were like 12 attending doctors, and nobody could figure out why he was dying. They just said he's being poisoned, but we don't know how. Every record of the guy was sanitized. His active bank accounts disappeared. I mean, just vanished into thin air with all of the money that his daughter used to run her family. Because, you know, obviously most people have someone else on their bank account. You know, just in a family, just for rights of survivorship. All of the bank accounts disappeared. All the life insurance policies disappeared. NYPD said he had never been a cop. She has the check stubs from his pension. photographs and, you know, with the shield and all that. Everything disappeared. The family was ruined. And I'm back there, and I'm going through these records, and I'm finding all of these military records. I find home addresses and numbers and names for, like, the whole board of directors of the Nugenhand Bank. I find, you know, home numbers for Paul Helliwell, a legendary CIA spook.
By the way, the Nugenhand Bank is something that's familiar to the veteran listeners to this program. Newer listeners might not be familiar with that, and that's a fascinating story in and of itself. Tell us briefly about that, if you would.
There was Michael Hand, a former Green Beret and an Australian by the name of Nugent. They formed a bank in Australia, and I'm probably going to get the year wrong. You can correct me. I think it was in the late 70s.
It was certainly in the 70s. I don't remember exactly when, although it was sort of an outgrowth of the Vietnam War and the
yes.
things that took place attendant on that.
Yes. What the bank wound up doing with all of these CIA officers and military officers, Edwin Black, I mean, there's a whole list of CIA and military people on there. They got a lot of military pensions, but they also just started laundering millions and millions of dollars in drug money and looting and funding covert operations. That was, I guess, the primary purpose. Michael Hand eventually committed suicide after the Australian government was wondering if it was being destabilized, you know. But that was a major scandal on CIA's hands.
And in fact, the labor government of Gough Whitlam was destabilized in part through the Nugenhand Bank.
Yeah,
the evidence is very conclusive.
So all of these names, after spending 2 or 3 days there, I was there with my then fiance. We're divorced now, but we went out there and interviewed Dee and realized that we had stumbled onto this gold mine. There were documents everywhere. There were records. There was incredible stuff. I made a list of about 30 names, many of which were fictitious. And I said, okay, you tell me if your father has ever talked about any of these people. And she perfectly picked out the entire board of directors of the Nugenhand Bank and did not go for any one of the false names.
Really?
Yeah. So I knew that, you know, we were on to, you know, Albert Caron was a major, major player. And so after spending all his time with her and gathering all the information to prepare to write my report and agreeing to help her, she's a wonderful lady. I mean, she knows that her father was a really evil guy, did a lot of bad things, but her family's been wiped out, and she's got wonderful spirit, and she's become a good friend because she absolutely has never lied to me, and I really respect that.
A note that we touched on in our earlier discussions, but Albert Caron, although he died in, was it 1990?
1990, you're right.
1990, but he is still listed by the military as active duty military, and the reasons for that are quite interesting.
Well, yeah, I mean, first of all, the report that I wrote is now his official military record, which is very strange. This is according to Dee. But also, he is still listed on active duty, even though he's dead and buried now some 8 years, is because of the fact that if they show him on active duty, they can't release any records about him. It's a right of it's a privacy act thing.
So
very funny.
Even though he's been dead for 8 years, he's still listed as living.
Right.
That in and of itself, I think, should alert listeners that there's something very significant about this case. That's rather extraordinary procedure.
Well, everything about this case is extraordinary because I told Dee that based upon my experience and all the years that I had put into researching it, there was only one guy who could help her, and that was Ted Shackley.
Mm-hmm.
And I had no idea at the time how to reach him. Well, Dee on her own hunted up another infamous retired spook living in New Mexico named Robert Mayhew, who had been Howard Hughes' chief of security and liaison with the CIA.
Now, Mayhew comes into this how again?
There was an association of retired spooks. He was living in Santa Fe.
Right.
Okay, so Dee made some calls. Her husband, I better not go into that just for her safety.
Sure.
She had some connections, and she found Mayhew in New Mexico, attended a luncheon with him, shook his hand, told her who she was, showed Mayhew her father's picture, and Mayhew gave her Shackley's phone number.
Fascinating, because Robert Mayhew was one of the key individuals involved with recruiting organized crime operatives to dispatch Castro at behest of CIA and others.
Isn't that a small world?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that special? Yes. So she called Shackley. Now, Caron is now buried at this point as a staff sergeant in a New Mexico military cemetery, which is the highest rank he attained during World War II. The Army said he never existed after World War II.
All righty, so he's a staff sergeant as of this point in time that you're describing.
That's the headstone.
Okay.
Within 10 days of contacting Ted Shackley, the headstone was changed to full colonel. And Dee has a copy of the order so directing from Washington. That will turn up in the lawsuit, too, but I can't go into more detail about that.
Right. One point I want to stress is that obviously this is a sensitive affair, and if the phrase loose lips sink ships ever applied, it does to this one. and it's certainly one thing that I want to stress again is that I think you and the others who are directly involved in this suit should be commended for your bravery. I personally consider you to be a genuine American hero, and I'm a crusty bastard, and I don't hand out compliments easily. But your bravery and integrity in this affair are to be commended. And I also want to repeat something I said earlier, that may God protect all of you who are pursuing the truth in this case. Having said that, excuse me, go ahead.
Thank you. The check's in the mail.
All righty. Great. Having said that, proceed with this fascinating tale. Now, Albert Caron is now dead and buried, having died in 1990 of...
chemical toxicity of unknown etiology.
Fascinating. And adding his list to the already very long number of deaths in connection with operations Watchtower, Orwell, etc. And I should also stress for listeners, as evidenced in RFA number 4 about the Turple Wilson operation, the people who were involved in various aspects of Turple and Wilson's cases and who were called to witness as witnesses or were participants have experienced a very high rate of mortality. Kevin Mulcahy, a former CIA officer who helped bring the case to light, died under strained circumstances before he could give witness. Frank Turple had a very acerbic comment in an interview that was in Penthouse magazine. He observed that former DIA operative who had been involved in helping to prepare order of battle reports for Muammar Gaddafi and who was about to testify in the case, died of a... he had a hunting accident in the laundry room of his girlfriend's apartment, which I thought was an interesting way of phrasing. And obviously,
yeah.
Frank Turple doesn't believe that that was a hunting accident. But so Albert Caron has died of chemical toxicity of unknown etiology. His headstone has listed him as a staff sergeant, but then D contacts Theodore Shackley and is put in touch with him by Robert Mayhew, and all of a sudden things begin to change.
Well, things begin to change on a number of fronts. D has had, I would guess, 4 or 5 different conversations with Ted Shackley, and he's absolutely flat out admitted to knowing Albert Caron,
mm-hmm.
that Albert Caron worked for the agency, which is in and of itself wonderful. For Dee. But she has also met, and coincidentally living in Albuquerque at the time, was the daughter of Colonel Ed Cutolo. And she had never met Dee. Dee found her. Dee has some resources.
Mm-hmm.
They met. Dee showed Cutolo's daughter a photograph of her father. And the daughter said, "Oh my God, he was at our house all the time when I was growing up."
Really?
Yeah.
And it was also by sort of a coincidence. By the way, if there's more that you wanted to add to this aspect of the story, please do so.
Well, I think we ought to wait for the lawyers to decide what's going to get said, where and when and how about that.
Sure. Again, I want to proceed deliberately in this. Bear in mind that this is a case that touches an awful lot of or laps upon many shores, ranging from Watchtower, Orwell, etc., to the Iran-Contra affair, on up to MENA, Arkansas, and even going stretching back in time to the assassination of President Kennedy. The connection between Bill Tyree and Albert Caron came about in sort of an interesting fashion, because Bill Tyree was not familiar with the name Dee Ferdinand was not familiar with the name Bill Tyree, but she had heard her father lament frequently about an individual named Sandy.
Right.
Could you develop that a little more for us?
Well, Caron's background was that he was the paymaster for almost any major or especially sensitive CIA covert operation, especially those involving special forces troops operating well outside of congressional approval, so mm-hmm. to speak. And he had been on, Caron had been the paymaster for the Watchtower missions. This was not known necessarily by Dee, because Caron did not necessarily always reveal to his daughter the names of all these operations. The only key names that he had mentioned to her were Amadeus and John Caffey, which turns up as a known alias for Oliver North. He did talk about Secord. He did talk about George Bush being Amadeus. I mean, that's an umbrella program of a multitude of operations, and he referred to George Bush always as Amadeus.
Mm-hmm.
Tyree, at the time that he was on the Watchtower missions, had sandy hair. He also had another nickname, Sandy, as a result of Operation Sandman, and you can guess what the purpose of those missions were. It's to put people to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And they had been in a couple of knockdown, drag-out firefights before, and Caron and Sandy had bailed each other out. They knew each other well. Now, Caron had taken the diaries, and I have to do a little correction from my last newsletter because in spite of the enormous research I do, I'm just like you. I'm one guy. I'm the copy editor. I'm everything.
Mm-hmm.
Caron had retrieved the diaries after Elaine Tyree's murder and stored them at the home. They had a large home in New Mexico in 80, but stored them for a brief period of time back in New York. And Dee herself and her husband, Tommy, had seen the diaries, but never was the name Tyree used. And over the years, Caron had carried a great deal of pain and always talked about making it right for Sandy, making it right for Sandy, talking about being on missions with Sandy and how Sandy got screwed and so on and so forth. Well, I didn't know there was any connection either. I had heard about Tyree independently. I'd met Dee through some CIA sources that turned me on to her, ex-CIA sources. And there was the common thread was an investigator in Washington, D.C., Bill McCoy, a retired warrant officer from Army CID, who was working very closely with Tyree. Eventually, what happened was that McCoy would mention Dee in conversations to Tyree, but he would use her married name,
mm-hmm.
which is Ferdinand.
Right.
Okay. Eventually, he mentioned the name Caron, and Tyree went through the roof. And this was not until, obviously, 1995. Okay. Well, Tyree went through the roof, and some initial conversations took place. But over a period of about 6 months, Dee realized that Bill Tyree in prison was the Sandy and that she had held and she and her husband had seen Elaine's diaries.
And so that essentially was how the link was made between, quote, Sandy, unquote, and Bill Tyree, which was the real name of the individual known to Caron as Sandy.
That's correct.
Or known to his family as Sandy.
Now, Bill McCoy passed away suddenly just about 8 months ago.
And he was one of the investigators for Christic Institute as well.
He had worked with Gene Wheaton at Christic, but he came in kind of late in the Christic case, but Bill McCoy remains to this day one of the best men I've ever known, and I really miss him.
Well, that wasn't to cast aspersions on Bill McCoy in any way.
No.
I think that the Christic Institute had a very, very bad rap. It was apparent to me, even as an academic researcher, that there were some serious factual errors, at least in the initial Sheehan affidavit. Yet at the same time, so much of what the Christic Institute had to say was already a matter of public record when it was filed. I think that they were unfairly demonized at the time and afterward. Yet at the same time, it should also be said that even though the vast bulk of what they said was accurate, that they did make some mistakes, which led to the deep sixing of the suit.
I don't think there's any question about the fact that they made some mistakes. I don't think there's any question about the fact that they were right about much of what they said.
There's also a huge overlap between many of the people they were looking at and many of the names that you've already mentioned. Moises Nunez, Frank Castro, and others were not only common to the Christic suit, but also to the Kerry investigation.
That's right.
This suit obviously touches on so many different things, and this is not to cast aspersions on the suit or any of the people involved in it, but one concern that I have is that even though there are evidentiary tributaries running between things like the Iran-Contra affair and FEMA, for example, and obviously the MENA Arkansas connection, and even stretching all the way back to the assassination of President Kennedy, a CIA officer named Gary Goldhill, for example, shortly after the assassination, told colleagues that he knew who had done it. He said that a faction of the CIA that was involved in drug dealing had done this. I personally believe there was more to it than that, although that was part of it. Goldhill then turned up and alleged suicide, although the gun, that the hand that he used to shoot himself was the opposite hand from the one that, I've forgotten whether it was a righty or a lefty, but the gun was in the wrong hand, suggesting that he was murdered. So there certainly is an there are evidentiary tributaries connecting many of these aspects, but playing devil's advocate, Mike, and I realize that you might not be in a position to answer this directly, and hopefully we will be interviewing Ray Coleman and or Bill Tyree, circumstances permitting in the future, but with such a sweeping scope in this, talking about not only naming not only Bill Clinton, or not only George Bush, but the CIA, Oliver North, now Bill Clinton, key Massachusetts officials, that is a very, very tall order. And what I'm wondering is if the sheer magnitude of the suit could be utilized against it from the standpoint of law, and I'm not versed in law.
Well, at first blush, everybody says, oh, this sounds like Christic.
Mm-hmm.
But it is absolutely not. And here's the reason why it's not. We have a civil judgment in a Massachusetts court.
Right.
With pleas of guilty, if you will, but it was a civil case. And an appellate confirmation in which Massachusetts authorities acknowledge that the diaries and photographs of Tyree in uniform, which showed him wearing all kinds of insignia to which the Army said he'd never earned, like his master jump wings and so on and so forth, were seized by the Air Police Department and the Massachusetts State Police. The court decisions, and there's another case going ahead, there's another move on this being made the 27th of October, to again compel either return of the diaries or actually the state of Massachusetts to cough up that, you know, hey, we turned them over because we know where they went. But these judgments and the Air Police guys already say, we know there were diaries, we took them.
Mm-hmm.
They're there. And the court order says, give them back. And they're not giving them back. Why? Because they can't, because they don't have them, because CIA got them
mm-hmm.
in 79 from Al Capone. Okay? So these decisions are right there, ironclad, and the Christics didn't have that to go on. Also, you have the former, the first trial judge in the case, Judge Killiam, who just said on an A&E documentary, June 13th, Murder at Fort Devens, that he absolutely believed that Bill Tyree was innocent and that he was framed.
Right.
So there is an enormously solid legal foundation for this lawsuit, which doesn't disappear. The Christic lawsuit fell because, well, the conventional wisdom is because its discovery aspects were way too broad, unfounded, and Danny Sheehan had a lot of mistakes in his filings. Now, Bill Tyree is in essence pro se in this, defending himself, although he has Ray Coleman's assistance. He has some latitude. He's doing this himself. But the point of the matter is that when you pull on a Tyree murder, you pull on this loose end. And when you pull on this loose end that's hanging there, which are the Watchtower missions, you pull up FEMA, you pull up MENA Arkansas, you pull up Iran-Contra, you pull up George Bush, you pull up everything because it's all connected.
Yeah, there certainly are, obviously, as I said, threads running through all of these things. Obviously, what I'm about to ask is a speculative element, Mike. One thing I think we can conclude is that the defendants aren't going to just roll over, at least not completely. I don't think the CIA is going to issue a report saying, you know, yep, you got us, you know, sure enough, we've been trafficking drugs. I don't expect to see George Bush going on national television saying, well, looks like the jig is up. You guys got me. I know it wasn't real prudent, but heck, you know, you can't win them all, you know. Guess I'm going to have to spend the rest of my life in prison, but, well, I know Barbara will bake me some cookies. We know that's not going to happen.
Right.
Where do you see the lawsuit going as a matter of practical resolution? I'm accessing the story because this is America, damn it, and these kinds of things shouldn't be going on, and the American people should know about these things, and they're not hearing about them, but as a practical matter, and again, I don't want you to say anything that you don't feel that you can properly relay on the air, where do you see the suit going?
Well, first of all, let me disagree with you on one point.
Okay.
because in Volume 2 of their own Inspector General's report, the CIA has just admitted to a conspiracy to traffic to protect drug traffickers,
mm-hmm.
which makes them accomplices, which they have admitted, and this was just released October the 8th, you know, was totally buried, but it's starting to, people are waking up. This is a major admission, which sinks Oliver North like you cannot believe, points directly to the National Security Council, which at the time was run by George Bush. So CIA has offered the evidence, and when Volume 2 gets meshed with Bill Tyree's lawsuit, I think you're going to see a lot of squirming going on, because it proves that there is a foundation for Tyree's lawsuit,
mm-hmm.
Or it helps to prove. It's one of the elements. Where do I see it going? I don't know. Like, I'm not the lawyer. I don't want to utter words that are going to be construed as if I'm sitting in a room negotiating, which I am not doing, and certainly not on the air. You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
I'm not trying to do that. But I do think, let me just say this. I will bet you that within a year, Bill Tyree is a free man.
That will certainly be a victory.
Yes.
That will certainly be a victory. Let me ask you another sort of open-ended question, perhaps one for which there's really no definitive answer. What would you recommend that listeners to this program, either on this station or the ones we hear it eventually on tape, do in terms of civic action? Is there something that you believe that they could do
yes.
which would enhance the possibilities of this case, either in the courts or as a political entity?
Well, without necessarily getting involved in Billy's case, which I think might be misdirected, inefficient expenditure of energy, we'll put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
There is something right now which more than ever in the history of this country will make a difference, and now is the time, if there ever was a time. First of all, go to the CIA's website at www.cia.gov. Get the report and read it. Or go to my website, find the relevant information, get some extracts, find the story, realize what CIA has admitted to in this report. And the reason why I want people need to do that now is because we have the most enormous opportunity I have seen in my lifetime to do something, because the report is damning. There have to be hearings on this. It has to be officially received by either the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence or the Senate side. The House Committee, of course, is chaired by Porter Goss, who's a retired CIA officer from the Miami station.
Mm-hmm.
Worked with that Shackley.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is, already I am aware. I'm being sent copies right now of letters that people are writing to Newt Gingrich, be that as it may, to the chair of House Permanent Select, basically, more importantly, to their own members of Congress and their senators, and to the White House, saying, I've looked at this report. I want open hearings. I want adequate notice. I want adequate publicity. This report is devastating. This government cannot function until you deal with this, because the crimes admitted to in Volume 2 are so heinous and the admissions so clear that if we don't say something about it, I'm really afraid for the consequences. If Volume 2 gets an adequate open public hearing, CIA, I'm telling you, is more than on the ropes. They're down for an 8 count at least.
All righty, Mike. Well, we are almost out of time. Your website again is www.cop versus CIA.
COPV, no S.
COPVCIA. And you can be reached by phone at 818-788-8791. The P.O. box, we've only got 10 seconds.
Is Box 6061-350, Sherman Oaks, California, 91413.
For Mike Rupert, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.